A cop pulls you over for speeding. He gets out of his car, and the moment he walks up to your window, he's got attitude. In fact, the first thing he tells you is, "Hey, buddy, I'm going to need you to get out of the car because I'm going to need to do a pat-down search for safety reasons." Number one, do you have to get out of the car? Number two, do you have to let him perform a pat-down search on you for officer safety? What if the cop finds something on you? Can he actually use it against you in court? And what is this officer safety business that we hear cops using all the time? We will answer all of these questions, how you should respond, and what you can do to protect your rights whenever police try to abuse this concept known as officer safety. Look, I wish I had a nickel for every police report that I've read where a police officer claimed he needed to search someone because they were being suspicious. This is being abused out there, and every one of us needs to know how this really works. So where did all of this start? I want you to imagine this for a second. Prior to 1960, the police interacted with us in only one of two ways. The first way was known as a consensual encounter. Let's say a cop walks up to you, starts talking to you, maybe you respond back. But here there's no real Fourth Amendment issues because there's no real criminal investigation going on and there's no real seizure. You haven't been held or detained. In that situation, you could walk away and you're free to leave. Number two, an arrest based upon probable cause. If a police officer has probable cause to believe you've committed a crime, he can then arrest you and then your Fourth Amendment rights kick in. Imagine this. Prior to this case we're going to talk about, notice Terry versus Ohio, there was no such thing as police detaining you or holding you on the side of the road while they perform an investigation. In fact, now most of the cases that I deal with as a criminal defense attorney involve this third way of police interaction, and it's when cops claim they have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is taking place, and now they want to further do a Terry frisk because they are concerned about officer safety. So, how did this third way of police interaction come to be? Well, this all came from the case of Terry versus Ohio. Now look, in that case, there was a detective. His name was Detective McFadden. He was a Cleveland detective of over 30 years, and he was out in his area, his beat, where he was always patrolling, except this time he was out wearing plain clothes, and he saw what he believed was strange behavior. In fact, it was Halloween night of 1963, and Detective McFadden said that he saw two men standing on a street corner, Terry and Chilton. These two guys were talking to each other, and then one of them would go down the street and look into a window. And when they looked into that window, they would come back, and then they would talk to the other one. They would do this several times and whisper back and forth to each other. Finally, there was a third guy that showed up. His name was Katz. He would come in, and he would begin to talk, walk around, looking in the same window, looking around the side of the building, and he would come back and begin to whisper to both Terry and Chilton. Now, according to Detective McFadden, he saw them do this a total of 12 times. Now, on cross-examination, Detective McFadden admitted that he didn't see them actually commit a crime, but he believed they were about to commit a crime, and he believed they were casing the place for robbery. Detective McFadden then seized all three men, and he performed the very first what we call Terry frisk or pat-down search. And in the process of doing so, of course, he found a .38 revolver on Terry, and Terry was then charged with carrying a concealed firearm. This is why this case was so important, because the Supreme Court was going to decide whether or not it was legal for the police to stop you, to search you, and then to seize whatever they find when there's no consensual encounter and the cops actually had no probable cause that you even committed a crime. In the case of Terry versus Ohio, the Supreme Court essentially said that what Detective McFadden did was reasonable. Now, what does that mean? Well, really what the Supreme Court did was made up a new law where the police may temporarily detain you if the cops are able to establish reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. But the key here is that the cops must articulate specific facts supporting their suspicion. And this is where cops go wrong all the time. I mean, just saying that someone is suspicious doesn't mean they actually are suspicious. This is where I see racial profiling come into effect, and you have cops claiming that almost anything they see could result in suspicious activity. Remember, they must articulate specific facts that establish this suspicion. Now, if and only if these cops provide these specific facts to detain you, this detention is supposed to only be a very brief period of time in order for the officer to investigate whether his suspicions are true or not. Now, here's the rule that they came up with. If the cops develop some type of actual probable cause, then they can arrest you. If they don't, then they're supposed to let you go. So the Supreme Court gave us the rules for whether an officer can temporarily detain you for a criminal investigation. But what if the cops now want to do an actual frisk of you? What if they want to pat you down for weapons? What's the rule here? The Supreme Court looked at the decision and said that Detective McFadden was reasonable in patting them down for weapons because they, quote, had reasonable suspicion that they were armed and dangerous. Armed and dangerous? During the trial, Detective McFadden testified that due to his training and experience, it led him to believe that they were casing the place out for a robbery. So if they're casing a place out for a robbery, it made him believe that they were likely armed. In fact, his testimony stated that an experienced detective would believe that someone casing a robbery would end up being armed. The Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court created this standard from Terry versus Ohio. Number one, the cops must have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is going on in order to temporarily detain you. But also, if they now want to do a pat-down search for you because of officer safety, the cops must also have separate reasonable suspicion to believe that you are presently, right now, armed and dangerous, and that the search is necessary in order to protect the officer from that threat. Notice how important this is with traffic stops. A cop just can't walk up to your window and start looking at you and not like something about you and pull you out of the car and frisk you and completely search you to find any weapons. He has to articulate that you are presently, you must be right now, presently armed and dangerous. It must be both, because it's possible that you could be armed but not dangerous. In other words, just because you're being pulled over doesn't mean that an officer gets the opportunity or privilege to pat you down because he wants to. The cops must have separate reasonable suspicion that you are right now armed and dangerous. A good example of this is the case of Ibarra versus Illinois. In that case, a cop showed up to execute a search warrant. And as they were there, they told everybody to stop what they were doing. Nobody could leave because they were doing a pat down for weapons on everybody present. Was that reasonable? Absolutely not. Once again, the cops must have specific facts establishing that that particular person was presently armed and dangerous in order to justify that pat down. So how do the cops come up with this separate reasonable suspicion to justify that they can pat you down for weapons? Let's examine a few of the tricks that I see cops use all the time to develop reasonable suspicion to pat you down for weapons. Number one, prior criminal history. This is one I've seen officers use quite a bit. Let's say the officer already knows the person. And then what do? Is they claim, oh, I know this guy, he's a violent guy. So now I had some concerns about officer safety. Or an officer, before he even walks up on a traffic stop, he's running your registration to find out who the vehicle's registered to, and now he can base his feelings of officer safety off of what he sees on prior criminal history. Additionally, think about the traffic stops when cops pull up and they ask for your ID, right? What do? They take it and they go, I'll be right back. They go back to the vehicle. One of the things they're checking for is warrants, active warrants. But secondly, they're also looking to see what type of prior criminal history you have so that they can size up their officer safety concerns. Number two, the cops will claim they see a bulge in your clothing that is consistent with a weapon. Notice how sloppy this is. Notice how subjective and opinionated it is. This bothers me because cops can almost see anything and claim they think it could have been a weapon. Number three, furtive movements that the cop might believe you were reaching for or holding some type of weapon. Now look, this is very opinionated, and I've seen cops look into almost anything to fit their opinion that maybe you were reaching for a weapon. But this is where you got to dig really deep into the facts of the case. What were you actually doing? Did you reach for your glasses? If you're reaching for your glasses, that is objectively not furtive movements. That doesn't establish any concern for officer safety. Now, it might be a different story if you're reaching up under your seat, you're going to the center console, you're going to your glove box. There, an officer might have an objectively reasonable belief that he has some officer safety concerns because you were doing so quickly. So it's important to really dig deep into the facts. In fact, when I say dig deep into the facts, it's really important that you not only look at the police reports, but you look at all the videos. Not only the video of the dash cam and the body camera, but hopefully the camera you used when you actually filmed the encounter. Otherwise, it becomes your word versus the officer's word, and you know how that can turn out. Number four, seriousness of the crime. Let's say a police officer is detaining someone because they match the description of someone involved in an armed robbery. There, an officer might have more room to be able to justify doing a pat-down search for weapons because maybe his officer's safety truly is at risk there. But what if it's a DWI? What if it's a shoplifting situation? It's important to recognize the seriousness of the crime to determine if the officer's fear of officer safety is reasonable. Here is my favorite. When police claim they received information from a confidential informant and that information allowed them to be able to do this pat-down search, that is a concern. That's a situation where we've had cases before where we will file a motion to suppress, and at trial, we want to get this confidential informant up on that witness stand and make sure and reveal not only who they are, but actually tear apart their so-called story about how those facts allowed sufficient information for the officer to pat you down and to be able to determine whether or not you had a weapon. But here is the key. The cops must articulate objective facts to support this. It can't just be based on their opinion. This is precisely why you should openly record every police encounter so that you're able to show that his claim of officer safety is bogus. Now, the cops now claim they have reasonable suspicion to establish that you are presently armed and dangerous. How is it that they are actually allowed to physically pat you down? Do they have any limitations? This brings us to the plain touch doctrine established by the Supreme Court case of Minnesota versus Dickerson. Essentially, this case says that the cops are limited to only searching your outer clothing and they are not allowed to manipulate anything that they feel during the search. In other words, if the cop starts patting you down for a weapon and he feels something, but he's not immediately sure that it's a weapon, and now he goes back in and he starts kind of digging around, clawing at it, trying to dig and see what it is, the cops now have a problem. Why? Because at this point, many courts will have ruled this has become an unreasonable search and an illegal search. It's important to remember that Minnesota versus Dickerson established that cops are limited to only a pat down of the outer clothing. They can't start flipping belts around and touching bare skin. What about heavy coats? I get that question all the time. This will depend upon your specific state law, but some courts have ruled that you can be required to remove a heavy coat in order for them to perform the search. The point I'm making is that the law is very clear that it is supposed to be only a minimum search, as little as possible in order to determine whether or not someone has a weapon on them. What about the cops saying they need to handcuff you in order to search you? There is some case law out there that establishes you can be handcuffed in order for them to perform the search. In fact, in situations I've seen, if the cop doesn't handcuff the person in order to complete the search because they're concerned about officer safety, then I actually challenge how dangerous the actual person was at all. I mean, if they are presently armed and dangerous, I would expect an officer to want to cuff them as part of that search. And if he didn't cuff them, that's an area to be challenged. Now, what can cops actually take from you if they find something during this Terry frisk? I want you to remember, the whole purpose of this search was for officer safety, and the courts have said very clearly, if they can articulate those facts for officer safety, the search must be limited to that purpose. The key here is, did the officer find something that would be consistent with a weapon? So it must objectively be consistent with a weapon. Now, many people say, Jeff, I have no idea what that means. This needs to be developed on cross-examination by a good criminal lawyer. And the way that works is what is the size of it? Is it hard? Is it soft? Could it be the structure or the shape of a weapon? These are the things that need to be objectively determined, because if it's something that is hard, long, and shaped like a gun or a knife, that's one thing. But what if it's soft and it's squishy? We're talking about something totally different. In fact, that's exactly what happened in the case I spoke about earlier of Minnesota versus Dickerson. In that case, the officer admitted that he was searching for weapons, but under thorough cross-examination, he admitted that after he was searching him, he knew he wasn't going to find a weapon, but he did find something that was soft, squishy, and felt a little bit like cellophane, and as a result of that, he seized it, which ended up being illegal drugs. Now, the problem with this cop is that he searched Mr. Dickerson and he found nothing that was hard, consistent with a weapon. He found something that was soft, squishy, was not consistent with the size of a weapon, but he went ahead and seized it anyway and arrested Mr. Dickerson. In fact, under cross-examination, the actual opinion says that the officer only figured out what it was by, quote, manipulating the object to determine that it was likely drugs. So the court's rule in Minnesota versus Dickerson was that if a police officer performs a Terry search and then he performs a lawful pat-down for weapons, and it is immediately apparent that what he finds is consistent with the weapon, then he is allowed to seize that item. But if it is not immediately apparent that it's consistent with a weapon, and the cop has to continue to manipulate it or move it around, now the courts have said this is no longer a search about officer safety. Now he's just on a fishing expedition. So how does all this work in practice? Why do we continue to see police officers using the claim of officer safety to search people only to find items that have nothing to do with weapons and charging people with it? Well, as case law has developed, the courts have essentially said that once the officer begins to do the pat-down search for officer safety, he must immediately know that it's contraband. Here's the key. The immediately apparent is the key to this. The officer must immediately know, and it must be immediately apparent that it's contraband or immediately apparent that it's a weapon. If the cop continues to have to dig or he's not sure, then it becomes an illegal search. Now, you know the real problem in this situation? I've been both a prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney for a long time, and I can tell you there's a lot of revisionist history that goes on after a cop does this. Cops start saying things like, in my training and experience, I immediately knew that this was contraband that I felt. But then I pull out a video on his body camera or a video of the guy that was sitting in the passenger seat. And what do I find? I find this officer digging in this guy's pockets for over 10 minutes trying to figure out what's going on. Good criminal defense attorneys are looking to see if it was immediately apparent what was found during that search. This is why we must have video. And even if the officer doesn't have his body camera on, it's important you have your camera going. Otherwise, you'll have the revisionist history of the police officer claiming in his police report that everything was immediately apparent based upon his training and experience. Remember, weapons are hard objects. If it is soft and not consistent with a weapon, the officer cannot manipulate it during the search. If he does, it's an illegal search. What if the cop claimed it was immediately apparent that it was illegal contraband? Whatever you do, don't believe him. Get the video. Look to see how the search went down. Did he keep digging? If so, it's an illegal search. In fact, this is one of the most successful ways that criminal defense attorneys are able to get evidence suppressed in illegal possession cases. Why? Because what will happen is, let's say an officer decides to do a Terry frisk. And as a part of that, he's searching and he starts to dig in someone's pocket, figuring out what it is that they have. Well, the moment on the body cam, I see this all the time, where you'll see an officer that he's digging in someone's pocket. He's like, what do you got in your pocket here, man? And he'll start digging and you'll hear it on the body cam and he'll go, what is this? And you hear those words, what is this? And then the next thing he says, oh, it must be crack. That's an illegal search. He's supposed to be searching for officer safety, looking for a weapon. He finds something very small and he doesn't know what it is. Now we have a problem with this search. So remember, Terry stops and pat-down searches are never automatic. Number one, the officer must always have reasonable suspicion some criminal activity is taking place to temporarily detain you. But then even after that, they must have separate reasonable suspicion that you are presently armed and dangerous in order to do a pat-down search. The Supreme Court may allow officers to do a pat-down search of you for weapons, but it's limited to only the outer clothing and they cannot touch your bare skin. In order for the officer to use whatever he finds during the search against you, it must be immediately apparent that it was either a weapon or that it was some illegal contraband. If he's even unsure just by a hint, it's an illegal search. Finally, remember, never consent. This is where I see police officers sometimes, before they even start the search, they'll say, hey man, I think I see something there in your pocket. Do you mind if I reach in there and grab it? Or, hey man, what is that? Do you mind if I reach in and pull that out? If you're not careful, if you consent, you're going to transform an illegal search into a legal search because consent cures all. Never consent. Now, what if the cops show up at your front door, knocking on the door, demanding to not only search you, but also search your home? Do you have to open the door? What can you do? Check out this next video where I cover exactly what you should do if the cops come knocking. See you over there.